League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hello and welcome back to the Sunday Podcast, presented by SportsShoes.com. I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
Every Sunday we get together with a guest from the distance running world,
giving you an insight into the lives and training of some of the UK's best athletes and coaches.
You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all major podcast streaming services.
You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Sunday Podcast, where we post about our past and present guests, host giveaways, and much more.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Welcome back, guys. This week, we spoke to 333 1500 metre man and Canadian international Will Paulson.
Hello and welcome back to another week. Happy bank holiday to you all. I mean, given Monday's a bank holiday, maybe gives you another chance to listen to this. So maybe the episode's so good, you just listen to it twice. Who knows? But yeah, as Lum says, Mr. Will Paulson on this week. OTC runner, coached by Mark Rowland, talked a lot about their relationship, why he thinks they click and work so well together. It might be the fact that they're both British. Talks about, obviously, Will's now representing Canada. So he had dual citizenship growing up, grew up in the UK, and now he's representing Canada. So talks about that decision as well. Of course, we talk about that 333. How could we not? Incredible opening performance from him. And, you know, Will was out in Flagstaff, got to watch him train a lot. And so kind of got talking to him in depth about the changes he made this year compared to last year. Last year, he openly admits he got it wrong. Altitude's a tough place when you do get it wrong as well. So kind of weighed up the pros and cons. And of course, we touch on the NCAAs. I'm sure Will won't mind me saying, but, you know, he got outdipped by a collegian in that race. The state of the NCAA right now is electric. And so we actually talk about his career in the NCAA, given that he went to Princeton, a very academic school. He studied biology for 4 years there. And he talks about the difference between that and most schools where, you know, Will was sitting exams, you know, the day of big track races in a hotel room with an examiner who got sent by the university to overlook him to make sure he took the exam and didn't cheat and whatnot. And, you know, that's the same day of imagine doing that in the morning and in the evening trying to race your best over 1500 at the NCAA track meet. So he kind of talks about that lifestyle he had through uni and then how he wanted to, you know, really give running a shot and therefore transitioned over to Arizona State University. And then that went exceptionally well. And then obviously how he fell into place and ended up at OTC. So a really fascinating podcast this week and a slightly different career to most. And look, Will's a great guy. Follow his track performances all season long. Chances are you're probably going to see him in Eugene right now. You're going to see him at the World Championships. You might see him at Birmingham. He really wants to get back to Birmingham and compete at the Commonwealth Games. That's another point we hit. You know, he lays out to us the story behind the ridiculous Canadian qualifying standards. I'm sure a lot of you saw the fuss on Twitter about the Canadian qualifying standards, given that I think the 800 was something like 143, the 1500 was sub 330, the 5K was 1355 or something. It was, the standards were incredibly fast. So he kind of explains that, you know, there's more to just nailing a time when wanting to represent Team Canada. So quite an interesting point there as well. So look, enjoy the podcast. I've rambled enough. Take care and we'll catch you next week.
Will, first of all, just welcome to the podcast. Great to have you on, mate.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks for having me on. Pleasure to be here.
First off, well done on that 333 the other night. You're obviously in Flagstaff at the moment, but talk us through the race itself. Like, did you see it coming?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. It was, you know, it's been a bit of a long time coming. I had a tough year last year where I just missed the standard and, you know, things just didn't quite go right for me. And I knew I had the sort of fitness and that to get there, and especially coming off the Flagstaff camp we had this year, you know, the training there went really well. I felt like I was ready for it, and I knew it was going to be a fast race, and it was. So, you know, we just went for it, and luckily it played out. So yeah.
Mate, what made, obviously, this Flagstaff camp that you came on, what made this one so good? Like, had you been before? Was anything, you know, certain things that you did this time around that you might not have done before?
Yeah. I think, so this was my second time up in Flag. We went last year as well. And last year was really tough for me. I really struggled, to be honest. I think I wasn't in as good a shape going into the camp last year. So I think that was a big part of it. I was just much fitter. I was coming off more consistent training going into the camp this year, which definitely helped. And I think I just knew a bit more what to expect and, you know, kept the efforts a bit more controlled, made sure I was running properly easy on the easy days, you know, when we weren't doing sessions on the track or whatever. And I think, yeah, I just got the balance right, I think, this time, which I didn't manage last year. So I sort of learned my lesson and, you know, all the proper hard sessions that we had, you know, be that at Buffalo or down at Sedona on the track, they all went really well for me this year. And I think that was just, yeah, like I say, a result of just coming in with better fitness and you know, pacing yourself and measuring your efforts, really, which you have to do at altitude, you know, otherwise it'll bite you.
Mate, I totally know what you mean. Obviously, I'm here, you know, with my brother and stuff at the moment. I'm not as fit as those guys, and it is a brutal place if you aren't quite, you know, if you haven't got a really good fitness base coming into it, I think. And, you know, those easy runs that you've been doing, I've seen, like, obviously you and Hayward, and you guys are literally, you seem to be jogging, you know. I mean, I spoke to Hayward the other day and he seems to be walking up the hills to keep his heart rate down. So talk a little bit more about that and why you do it.
Yeah. And absolutely. I mean, it's just, I think that was one of the biggest things I've taken away so far from, like, Mark's training and training as a professional has been, you know, when to really push and when to know, you know, to hold back. I think it's important. You've got to, you know, you've only got a finite supply of energy and fitness, and you've got to know how to spread that out. And, you know, Mark, our coach, has always sort of emphasized the importance of the sessions. You know, the sessions is where you're getting the real benefit. You know, obviously getting in the miles helps for endurance and aerobic work, but, you know, you're much better off running 7:30 pace if that's what you have to do to keep your heart rate low enough, if it means that you can then perform well on the session days. So, you know, as you say, you know, when we were out in Flagstaff, you know, I basically always run with a watch and heart rate monitor, and, you know, I try and keep my heart rate averaging, you know, below 140. And if that means that you're almost walking up the hills, as you say, then so be it. You know, that is what it is. And I think it's one of those things, like, yeah, people can be a bit guilty of worrying too much about the heart rate and paces and stuff too much. But I think at altitude, I think that's really important. And I think it's very easy to overdo it if you're not careful. And, you know, luckily that was a balance, I think, you know, I got right this time. So
I'm interested to just talk about, you know, when you guys dropped down to Sedona, would you still make pace adjustments? Because for those people who don't know Flagstaff, Sedona is it 1300 meters? And Flagstaff is, like, what, 2100 meters?
Yeah, I'll be honest, I don't know in meters, but I think it's like 4,500 at Sedona or something like that.
Yeah, so it's like just below that.
And like 7,000 at Flag.
Yeah. So yeah, like, would you make pace adjustments, recovery adjustments down in Sedona, or would you just try and kind of rip that race pace even when you were down there?
No, definitely. You still got to make adjustments. I mean, you know, 4,000 feet is no joke. You still feel that difference, definitely. So, you know, we were making adjustments. It tended to be more, I would say, in terms of lengthening the recoveries than slowing down the pace. So, you know, I had a few good sessions down there. And the last session we did down there, you know, we were still running 60s for a K rep in Sedona. So, you know, we were cracking on at a decent pace, but, you know, you just have to make the recoveries that much longer because you're just not catching your breath otherwise. So, you know, we were lengthening the recoveries to, I don't know, like 4 minutes or a lap jog rather than, you know, maybe we'd have usually done it off 2 minutes or something. So, yeah, you definitely still got to make adjustments. Even though, as you say, it's only 1,000 300 or whatever, or 4,000 feet. But yeah, definitely still feel the difference.
Yeah. You mentioned the kind of the emphasis on those session days, and obviously you mentioned a workout just then. Was there a workout you did leading up to the 333 that you like, yeah, I know I'm really far in now, I'm ready to go?
Yeah. I mean, we had two really good sessions down in Sedona that I think for me sort of signaled that I was ready to run quite fast. The first one we did was 8 400s and then 3 broken 1500s, so into like 1200, 300. So that one's actually, I think the Sweat Elite guys came down and videoed it. So that one's actually on YouTube if anybody's interested in watching it. But I mean, that one went really well. And, you know, I knew off that I was, you know, it just felt controlled, you know, we'd done similar sessions last year when we were in Flagstaff, and just looking back at the time, you know, looking back at the times in my log, but also just remembering how I felt, you know, last year I was on the ground for like 5 minutes, 10 minutes after the session, just couldn't move. I was dead. Whereas this one, you know, it was like, I could have run another set if we'd had to, you know, and it's that feeling of control when you're still running good paces, I think, you know, that really gave me that confidence. So that was a great session. And then we had some K's. What was it we did? It was K86, I think. Sets of K86 we were doing. And again, that one, you know, we were starting out at 60s for the K's and, you know, getting a bit quicker. And so that, again, just felt, you know, easier than I expected it to, I'll be honest. Remembering how it felt the last, and I was expecting to go down to Flag every time and like bury myself, and it just didn't happen, but I was still hitting the times I had to hit. So, you know, at that point you kind of know, all right, like, you know, I'm in better shape than I was, and I'm ready to do something decent.
Yeah. And then what was the transition like from Flagstaff down to, you know, that Brian Clay meet in California? Did you just drop down like a couple of days before and your body seemed to respond okay?
Yeah, well, we actually came down just the day before. So we flew down on Thursday afternoon and raced Friday night. We were originally going to run at Mount Sac on Saturday. So that was what we'd originally planned. But then things changed and, you know, it was looking like Brian Clay was going to be the better meet. So we're like, all right, well, we're going to race Friday. But by then, obviously, we had all the travel booked and everything. So it wasn't bad at all. It's, you know, it's a shortish flight. And we just went down the day before, chilled out, and rested up, slept in a bit on Friday morning, and we're ready to go. And, you know, thankfully, I felt good warming up and stuff for the race, and it went all right. So
it did. And, you know, to put that meet into context for, you know, British listeners, what was it? Something like 30 guys ran sub 340?
Yeah, 30 guys under 340 is crazy. Yeah.
And your race alone, I don't even know how many were kind of inside 337. It almost the whole field seemed to be inside 338, 337. Yeah. So, but yeah, talk us through the race and why you chose to kind of, because there was a point in the race where you really got after it. It's like a split decision, that kind of crucial third lap, they say, in a 15. And what was the reasoning behind that, as opposed to kind of racing for the win, if you like?
Yeah, definitely. Well, as you say, as you know, it was Brian Clay's, it was my season opener for me. And it's always a bit of a time trial sort of meet anyway, just with where everybody's at in the season and the way the races are run and paced. You know, I went into the meet knowing, well, not knowing, but feeling like I could run fast enough for the standard. You know, I was pretty confident of that. And, you know, the pace was set to be, you know, 57. So right on for that time. In the end, the pace got out pretty hot. I mean, as you guys probably saw, it was, we were fast out of the gates. So I think, our first pacer, is a great guy. I actually know him from my time at ASU, but yeah, he got out a little hot, so we went out and we were through, I think, 200 in like 25 26, and I mean, I heard somebody call the time to me, and I was like, oh, okay, all right, this is going to be interesting. But, you know, we were smart enough to back off a little bit there off the paces. And Rob Heppenstall, the second pacer, actually did a great job as well. He backed off a little bit. I mean, he knew it was too quick. But yeah, I mean, from the start, I just slotted in near the front behind George Kuch. You know, I just didn't want to get in any trouble. I prefer to run near the front anyway. Just, you know, keep an eye on what's going on, and you're there when the move is made. So, yeah, slotted in there. We ran, you know, a solid first two laps. I think we were through in like 54, 55, maybe, through the first lap. So it's pretty hot. And then, threw in like 153 through the eight, and I'll be honest, I just felt good. You know, I didn't feel like I was working that hard. We got to the K and it looked like George was slowing a little bit, so I made the move there to pass him and caught up with Rob, who was pacing. And you know, I was just moving faster than him at that point. So I said, you know, I just thought to myself, all right, well, we're just going to go from it from here. And so, you know, I hit the bell and just sort of went for it from there. And, you know, in hindsight, maybe I went a little hard. You know, I think I kicked quite hard from the bell. But I knew going through the bell, I saw the time, and I knew, you know, I only needed, like a 60 or something to hit the standard. So I was like, all right, well, it's on but you don't want to miss it, and you know, by jogging it in or something. So I properly went for it, and again was feeling great down the back straight, and it just caught up with me in that last 100, as you know, anyone who's seen the video will see. It's a pretty tough last 50 meters for me, and you know, Kipsang got me, but it's what it is. You know, I was just there to run the time. I didn't really care about winning. I just wanted to run the standard. And obviously it's always nice to win, and I would have liked to have won, but there was nothing I could do. He was just moving faster than me at the end there, and the lactic had got me. So I swam it in for the last 20 meters, but still made it. So it's all right.
But what did Mark Rowland say after you to the race? Because I've heard he's a man of, you know, few emotions.
Yeah, he's certainly a man of few words. Yep. he was pleased. He's very pleased. You know, I think he knew last year, you know, obviously was a big disappointment for me, and he knew I was capable of running the time last year, and he knew how well obviously the training had been going in flag and everything. I don't know if he expected me to run the time there on the first run out, but yeah, he was definitely pleased and gave me well done. But I mean, you know, with Mark, a shake of the hand and a well done is about as good as you're going to get. So, yeah, I did make sure to remind him though that I now had a faster PB than him in the 1500.
So. They love that.
Which, yeah, that was the biggest accomplishment of the day, really.
Yeah. you mentioned last year, and obviously, huge year of the Olympics and things, and you narrowly missed out. Have you had a chance to reflect on that now? And how kind of different did it feel this year, like going for a time?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I've had quite a bit of time to reflect on it. I mean, I last year, as I say, I missed the standard by like 0.4 of a second or something. And, you know, it was a case of, I think I was just unlucky. I got ill at the wrong time. You know, we were really aiming to run the time at the Portland Track Festival last year. And that was where, you know, Jake and Vince, you know, my other teammate, they both ran the standard in that race. And I just missed it. But, you know, the week leading into it, I picked up some sort of a cold or bug or whatever. And, you know, I was coughing and hacking all week leading into it. And, you know, we just made the decision that I was going to try and race anyway, just because, you know, I needed the time. And what with COVID and everything, we'd started later in the season. We were generally kind of short on options on races to actually go for the standard. So, you know, we made the decision to try for it anyway. But, you know, I was sort of running a couple of miles every other day that week leading into it. Gave it my all on the day, just wasn't quite enough. But I think that sort of effort when I was already under the weather just sort of buried me a little bit. And, you know, at that point, I was just digging myself a deeper and deeper hole every week, trying to run the standard, you know, stressing because I hadn't run the standard, then trying to figure out which meet am I going to go to next to run the standards, you know, oh, it's in 4 days. Am I going to be ready? You try and race again, you run even worse. And it's just sort of a vicious cycle. So, you know, it was really difficult mentally and physically, you know, it took a toll on me. And what, by the time, you know, I got to the end of July, the, you know, the end of the qualifying window, and I had a couple of days and I just knew, all right, well, that's it. I'm not going to run the standard, unfortunately. And with the world rankings the way they are, like, I wasn't going to qualify off that either. So yeah, it was tough, but I, you know, I just called it a day and enjoyed some time off and, you know, watched my teammates race at the Olympics, which was, you know, exciting, but bittersweet, obviously, as well. But it just gave me that much more motivation to sort of get it right this year. And, you know, so far, touch wood, you know, it's gone a lot better. And the training has been, since that summer, the training's been a lot more consistent. I've sort of stayed on top of little niggles that, you know, could turn into injuries. And, yeah, I mean, really the key for me, it's just been consistency, getting in consistent miles, and consistently good sessions. And all of that is sort of, I think, partly, you know, motivated by that disappointment from last year, and sort of wanting to prove that, you know, I am good enough to be at this sort of level. I am good enough to, you know, to be a part of this group. And, you know, I'm not just here to take part in these races or whatever. You know, I want to be competing for the win and I want to be there at the major championships. And I wasn't last year, but, you know, I've really felt like I had a point to prove, and I want to be now, you know, for every major championship that's coming up in the next few years.
Sounds like you're more hungry than ever, coming off the back of last year, and that's kind of fueled you all winter long. And you often see that, don't you?
Yeah, definitely. It's exactly that. You know, it happens, you know, in our sport and in any sport, you know, there's often disappointments and things don't always go to plan, and you just got to find a way of using that disappointment as motivation to get better and to improve for the next opportunity that you have. And that's what, you know, I feel like I've managed to do quite well so far, you know, this winter leading into spring and then summer. Yeah.
Then, you know, in a healthy way, you obviously would have watched Jake run last year, and you would have been training with him throughout the winter and stuff. Have you kind of been keying off him a little bit and just knowing, you know, if I can, you know, run with Jake, keep up with Jake, I'm going to be in a very good place? Or is more individual, you know, because I have heard sometimes Roland makes it quite individual.
Yeah. I mean, Mark is very good at that, at tailoring the training for individual athletes. Absolutely. And, you know, if he feels like, you know, the training session that he's setting for one 1500 guy isn't quite right for the other 1500 guy, that's fine. Mm-hmm. He'll just make you do different sessions. And, you know, that has happened a decent bit. And to be honest, I haven't trained too much with Jake since last summer, just because we've come in at different points, because obviously he was coming off the games. So sort of took his season break a bit later than I did. I took it earlier and then sort of got back into the aerobic stuff quite early. So we're at just different points in that sense. And then, you know, I don't think he'll mind me saying, you know, he's had a few little niggles recently that have just set him back a little bit, but I mean, he's still in great shape. So it just sort of, you know, and then he was back in the UK for a little while when we first got to Flagstaff. So I haven't trained too much with him, but certainly sort of, you know, last year when I was doing all my sessions with him, you know, leading into that summer, and you definitely do key off, you know, your teammates a little bit, and you think, oh, well, you know, I've been doing all the same sessions as them, you know, there's no reason why I shouldn't be able to run the same races as them. You know, you definitely can be guilty of falling into that trap a little bit, and it's not always a trap, I suppose, but definitely, you know, the sessions that I have run with him and this year, you know, I have felt, well, you know, look, you know, I know how talented of an athlete Jake is and, you know, what he's capable of. And if, if we can train together, then great. And it's obviously a very good indicator of you know, what's possible if you're training with him, doing the sessions with him. But at the same time, yeah, you gotta be confident in yourself and your training. For me, it's been more a case of that this year. You know, a lot of the training has just been either, you know, by myself or with Vince. I've trained a lot with my teammate Vince Ciati. So, you know, and hopefully for him, it'll be a case of, well, you know, if he's comparing or whatever, he can say, look, I've done a lot of the same sessions with Will, and he's run the standard, and you know, there's no reason why he shouldn't soon. And I'm confident that he will, you know, in a couple of weeks when we try for it next. So
sure. Let's talk about your teammates then and the group as a whole, because obviously with Oregon Track Club, coach for Mark Rowland, one of the most famous groups and prestigious groups in the world. How did it all come about, and how long have you been with them now?
Yeah, so I've been with OTC just over 2 years now. So I joined in, I think, November of 2019. So just before all the COVID stuff started. Yeah, for me, the way it worked out was it sort of came about through my coach at Arizona State, this guy called Corey Leslie. Great guy. He ran professionally as a steepler for the US, coached briefly at Arizona State, and now is coaching the new group that's just started up in Baltimore, the Under Armour group. So he was my coach there for the 1 year that I was at ASU, and he always, you know, spoke very highly of Mark and was keen to help me find, you know, the right group once I graduated to sort of push me on to that next level. And you know, he had actually, in his professional career, he almost went to Mark, and he had some good connections there and put me in touch. I met with Mark in Phoenix when they came down that, what would have been spring of 2019. So they were up in Flagstaff for altitude camp. Mm-hmm. And he popped down to Phoenix, and, you know, I had a chat with him, got on really well. I liked his coaching philosophy and everything. And, you know, having, for me, part of it was also, you know, I knew how good of a coach he was from his reputation, obviously, but also, you know, when I got to meet him, he reminded me a lot of my club coach from when I was growing up in the UK. And also just that general sort of philosophy and mentality, I think, was a lot more familiar to me. It's the way he coaches and sort of the feeling in the group. It feels a lot more like that sort of British club system rather than the sort of American collegiate system, which I liked. So yeah, you know, I chatted with him, met up a few more times, and then ultimately, yeah, when I graduated from ASU that summer, I moved up to Eugene in the autumn, and yeah, I've been here ever since. So it's been an interesting few years with COVID. You know, it's not exactly been everything I was sort of expecting as a pro athlete career, but hopefully sort of now, you know, again, touch wood, hopefully that stuff's sort of all clearing up a bit now, and you know, we'll be able to have a bit more of a normal looking season with, you know, some European races and things like that as well, hopefully this year. So looking forward to that.
I agree, I think this season's going to be a big one. Everyone's already getting pretty excited. The time's coming out already, like you say, that meet you just did is phenomenal. But like I say, the cool thing about Mark is he is a Brit, so did you find yourself connecting with him a little bit more on that front? And you talk about the differences between him and a collegiate coach. What's like the biggest difference, I guess?
Yeah, definitely. I had that connection, as I said, you know, I represent Canada, but you know, it's no secret that I grew up in the UK and in the British club system. So definitely, you know, some familiarity there, and that did appeal to me. In terms of differences, I think, you know, the what you said earlier about Mark's training being very individualized, I think is probably the best way to put it. It's all of his training is tailored towards the individuals. And, you know, we, in the last few years, we've often had individuals come in who are maybe haven't had the best few seasons, or have been particularly injury prone or something in their career with previous coaches, haven't quite had the success that they wanted and are looking to make a change. And I think Mark's great at doing that. He's really good at adapting the training for the individual, be it around, you know, injury prevention or just the background that they're coming from in terms of their training. And, you know, for example, I mean, Jake, when he came to the group, you know, had run really well as a junior, run some phenomenal times, but had been struggling with injuries for, you know, at least a year, if not more, before he came to OTC. And then, you know, just look at where Mark managed to get him, you know, in the space of a year and a half, 2 years. Same with, you know, on the American side, we had Chanel Price, who was sort of in the twilight years of her career. She came in, you know, wanting to make a change. She had a lot of injury problems again. She, you know, she was a world indoor champion from, you know, I think it was 6 years, 8 years maybe before she came to OTC. Stayed with OTC for 2 years, and, you know, in that time, you know, made the final of the US Olympic trials, just missed out on going to the Tokyo Games, and ran a new personal best in the 800. So, yeah, I think he's just very good at tailoring the training. And, you know, you can tell that because of the amount of time that he spends thinking about it. You know, he's always thinking about it. You know, he tells us, like, I remember him telling me, like, he sleeps with like a pen and a pad of paper, like, next to his bed, because he'll wake up in the middle of the night with an idea and he'll write it down, like, for someone's training. So he literally, like, lives and breathes training, which is brilliant. And that's why he's so good at it. So yeah, I mean, I think that's what I would say about him. And also, just, he's very British, I think, in his approach. Is, as you say, he's a man of few words, and, you know, unlike American coaches, he'll be like, hey man, that was a great job, that was awesome. You know, the best you'll get is like, well, one bad sort of thing, you know. And yeah. But you know how much it means when you really get, you know, praise for a session or a race, because, you know, it's not often that you get that sort of praise, which works for me, doesn't necessarily work for everybody, but yeah, I get on really well with him. And, you know, compared to the American collegiate system, where a lot of my experience and a lot of the experiences that I've heard have been sort of a case of, you know, the coach comes up with a training, gives 30 guys the same training. It works out for some, it doesn't work out for others, you know. But that's kind of just how it goes. That's sort of seen as okay. It's like, well, you know, that shouldn't be, in my mind, that shouldn't be how you train athletes, and certainly not at this sort of level. You know, everybody's different, and therefore everybody needs different training. And sometimes it's just small adjustments. Sometimes it can be radically different from other athletes running the same event.
I totally agree. It seems like there's a real sort of 1500 meter group forming, you know, at OTC at the moment as well. So there's a bit of a sweet spot going down. But, you know, you studied at Princeton, didn't you? For 4 years in biology. Was there a point, you know, where you obviously went and did a master's at like ASU, you know, down in Phoenix. But was there a point where you were kind of weighing up continuing running compared to getting a job? Because
there have been moments, definitely. You know, I think I always wanted to give running at a professional level a go, because, you know, it was what I've loved doing, and I've done it for so many years, you know, since being a kid. But you know, it can be difficult, and I was, you know, my fair share of injuries, some more serious than others. And, you know, there's definitely times where, when I was in college, you know, at Princeton, I had a foot injury that put me out for a full year. I didn't compete for a whole year. And, you know, you do sort of start to wonder, like, oh, well, am I going to be able to come back from this? But I guess for me, it was, part of it was, as I say, loving what I do and wanting to be the best at what I do. And part of it was also, I guess, not knowing what I would do instead. You know, I was kind of, it's like, yeah, I did a degree in biology, but I had no idea what I would have gone into as a career instead if I hadn't, you know, hadn't gone on to become a professional athlete. So sort of just glad I did. And the way I look at it is, you know, almost every other career can wait. You know, track isn't exactly a sport where you're going to make money that will set you up for life. Mm. You know, you can, but most people don't. So, you know, I'm realistic and I know that I probably will have to get, you know, what people would call a more normal job at some point afterwards. I don't know what that's going to be yet, but the way I look at it is, well, you know, I've got plenty of time to figure that out and I don't really want to worry about that too much at the minute. So, I guess there were moments where I've had my doubts, but in general, I think I was always pretty confident that it would work out or hopeful that it would work out. And thankfully it did. So, yeah.
Because the program at Princeton, it's probably a lot different to say the program like at NAU, you know, up in Flagstaff. Mm-hmm. Like those guys live and train like pros, double session days. You know, when were you ever kind of looking at other programs and thinking, yeah, that's a little bit more, you know, geared towards actually training as opposed to the academic side?
Yeah, definitely. As you say, the degree and the education at Princeton is quite strenuous in terms of the workload. Like, yeah, you're not, and unlike some other colleges, you know, in the US, you don't really get a pass because you're an athlete. Like, mm-hmm. you're expected to do the same classes, you're expected to turn up to everything, and you know, you're not going to get out of doing exams or get out of assignments because you've got a race or anything like that. You know, I remember being at the the East Regional Championships, trying to qualify for the NCAAs, and the morning before my second race, you know, I was sitting in the gym of the hotel we were staying at with a professor who'd been sent from the university to do my exam, like to give me the exam. Like,
oh, God.
They were that serious about it, you know? And so, yeah, definitely. There were times, you know, I was looking at, other students at other schools and, you know, I'd got quite a few mates who've gone to different colleges in the US and talking to them about it. And they're like, that's crazy that you had to do that sort of stuff. You know, we just, you know, your advisor or whatever would tell you not to take this class or would like talk to the professor and you get out of this or whatever. And there was none of that, for instance. So it was definitely, and I don't regret it because, you know, the reason I went to Princeton was, you know, it's a good school, obviously academically it amongst the Ivy Leagues, it was by far and away the best, in terms of athletics and track. So, you know, I wanted to go somewhere where the degree I had would be useful for me later in life. And, you know, the nice thing I can say is, well, you know, I'm always going to have that Princeton degree. And as you just asked me about, you know, other jobs or whatever that'll come later, you know, I'm hoping that that degree will be useful for me somewhere down the line. But yeah, there were definitely times where it was tough to balance the academics and the athletics. And, you know, there are days where you have to pull an all-nighter to get some work done. And then you try and turn up for the session the next day and you feel grim. And, you know, on those days, you're like, God, why do I do this? But, you know, I made it through the 4 years. And, you know, when it came to the end of that, and I still had some eligibility to use in the NCAA, you know, I'd made up my mind that what I wanted to do was go somewhere where I could have that other experience where the athletics and the sport is really put first. And as you say, you know, you can almost train as a professional in a way. And that was what I got at ASU. You know, I went there on a full scholarship. I went there because I like the place. I like the coach. You know, the climate is great. And when I was there, you know, I took mainly online classes and, you know, didn't have many lectures to go to, didn't have many assignments to submit. And, you know, trained as close to being a professional as I possibly could, really. You know, it was a lot of it was on my own time schedule. You know, I'd say, you know, Corey would ask me, say, all right, when do you want to work out? And I'd tell him, all right, we're going to work out at 7 p.m. And he's like, okay, fine. I'll find one of the guys to pace you for the session. And that was it, you know? And I think that really helped me. That 1 year was where I sort of made that transition from being like a 339 guy to I ran 336 by the end of my time at ASU. And, you know, without that, I don't know if I'd have made it, you know, in the professional world or, you know, been able to get into a group like this one. So, you know, there's obviously different advantages to the two sort of places that I went to. And, you know, I'm grateful for having been to both, but they were definitely very different.
Obviously, you ended up at OTC. Was there a point when you considered coming back to the UK and trying to make it there, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, it's not something I would have ruled out. But I think, you know, what with the fact that I compete for Canada, you know, I was probably more likely to go and base myself in Canada, I think, once I'd finished at ASU. You know, I have a good relationship with and some ties to the Club d'Athletics University Laval, which are based at Laval University in Quebec City, where sort of half of my family live around there. And, you know, I know the coach there, and he's coached some very good athletes, including Charles-Philibert Thibault, CPT, I think, as most people know him, the Canadian 1500 runner. So, you know, that would have been probably something I would have considered before going back to the UK, just because of, you know, the ties I have to the country that I represent and things like that. And, you know, it would have been a great group, I'm sure, to join had I done that. But as things played out, it worked out with OTC. And I be honest, I didn't really look at too many other professional groups, and I'm not sure there were too many others that were interested in me. But but yeah, I'm certainly glad that this is where I ended up. And, you know, yeah, couldn't be happier really with that. So,
yeah. Was it always in the plan to, well, you didn't transfer to Canada because you are a Canadian, you've got Canadian passport and stuff anyway, haven't you? So
yeah.
Like, obviously you would have had to make a decision. And was it always kind of an easy decision to go with Canada and given most of your family and stuff are from there?
Yeah. I mean, it's not entirely easy. And, you know, yeah, as you say, I've been a Canadian citizen from birth and have always held two passports. So there was always the option there. I actually first, as you guys may know, you know, I competed for GB as a junior. I mean, Matt, I mean, we were on a team together for the SIAB back in 2011, many years ago.
My goodness, yeah, remind me.
I mean, obviously, you know, growing up in the UK and competing in the British club system and the English school system and stuff like that, it's like, obviously, you know, I have ties and to the UK, and you know, my parents live there, and it was a difficult choice that I had to make between, you know, competing for GB or competing for Canada as a senior. But ultimately, I think, you know, as I said, you know, I have lots of family in Canada, so close family ties there. But also what with being in the US for 6 years for college, it kind of felt like that was where I was going to stay. And then once I knew I was with OTC, you know, it made a lot more sense to be competing for Canada. It's obviously a lot closer. And just the way that I was treated by, you know, Athletics Canada versus British Athletics, you know, I'm not trying to badmouth anyone here, but, you know, I felt a lot more welcomed by Athletics Canada and, you know, the opportunities that they gave me. And, you know, considering that I was, you know, a guy who'd grown up in the UK, I was readily accepted and sort of welcomed by them. And that was never sort of a feeling that I got, you know, with the British system. And it was, yeah, I mean, without wanting to go too much into it, it just, you know, I was felt like I was treated better by Canada. And, you know, that sort of encouraged me to want to go on to represent them at a senior level. And, you know, mm-hmm. that's what I've done. So
nice. Yeah. Is that, Was that first representation? Was that the Pan Am Games you did?
Yes. Yeah, it was. Yeah. So that was my first Canadian team in 2019.
And that went pretty well, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't bad. Yeah. Yeah. Came home with the bronze. So I was pretty pleased with that. Again, obviously you always want more, but yeah, I was pretty pleased with that, to medal on my first outing for Canada. And yeah, it was a great experience.
Now, I was just going to say, we can't not talk about Canada athletics when we talk about their Commonwealth Games standards. those are ridiculous. I can't remember what the 1500 is off the top of my head, but I know the 5K is it 12:55 or something, or sub 13. And
yeah,
you know, the standards are pretty much world-class standards.
Yeah.
Will we, you know, is the Commonwealth Games in your plan? Is it kind of like they set the standards, but they're still select a team if you haven't hit the standards? Like, what is the story behind that? No?
Yeah. Absolutely. I think there's been a lot of misunderstanding with the Canadian standards, and it's caused a lot of drama, I think. But like, a lot of people haven't really read the fine print in it. It's not so much a case of like, these are the standards, you have to hit these if you want to be selected. It's not that. The way they've done it, it's all a very sort of like stats driven approach to it. And I think it's also been done by Simon Nathan, who's the performance director, who's also incidentally a Brit. But the way they've done it is basically that, you know, the team size for Canada isn't very big. They can take 31 athletes. And so what they've done is they've, you know, in order to maximize their chances of winning medals, they've looked at the current world rankings, or the world rankings for the last 2 years or something like that. And they've said, all right, well, this is sort of the mark that puts you in the top 10 in the world, say, for each event. So that's what they've given as the standards. Now, that doesn't mean you have to run that time or jump that distance or whatever to be selected. What they're doing basically is just comparing each individual athlete to that standard in their respective event. So, and then they'll rank you as sort of a percentage of the standard. So, you know, you could be at 98% of the 1500 standard. And if that puts you within the top 31 athletes in Canada, then they'll pick you for the team. So it's not a case of, it's not a hard and fast standard. It's more a sort of benchmark, if you will. But certainly it won't be the easiest team to make. You know, it's probably going to be harder than the world's team, I would say. You know, world's obviously is just you make the standard, you get an invite. I think, you know, for the 1500, I think it might take a sort of 3:32 performance to get picked for that team. I'm not 100% sure quite how it works with like world rankings bonus points, if those are included in the tally. If they are, then that changes things. And but absolutely, it's, you know, the Commonwealth Games is in my plan, and you know, I hope to be able to qualify for that, because, you know, it's the Commonwealth Games. Not only is it the Commonwealth Games, but it's in Birmingham, which is, you know, an hour away from where I grew up and where a lot of my family live in the UK. So, you know, I absolutely want to qualify for that and be able to compete in the Alexander Stadium again. And hopefully have, you know, as many of my family on my dad's side, you know, the British side, come and watch. So, definitely in the plans, but we'll have to see, what races I can get into to get those points and to get those, performances to, you know, to get picked for that team.
That's a really interesting way of doing it. They're kind of going to match you up against, you know, the standards, the times they've set, and that allows them to, like you say, because they're not going to take an athlete across every event, are they? So they're going to be some events which are going to be vacant. There's going to be no Canadian competing. So in order to make that judgment, they've had to, like you say, kind of score your performance on a percentage.
Exactly.
That's an interesting way of doing it.
But, you know, I think, although it looks sort of outrageous on the face of it when you look at it the first time, and you know, I thought that the same as you. When I looked at it, I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, what are they thinking? You know, I mean, because the 1500 standard that they've put in is faster than the Canadian record for the 1500. So, you know, obviously I thought, what on earth is going on here? But once you read into it properly and see how they're doing it. It makes more sense. And yeah, as you say, the team is quite small, so you've got to be selective. And I mean, the team size is not determined by Canada. That's the Commonwealth Games organizing committee or whatever decides how many athletes each country is allowed to send. So that's not a Canadian decision to send only 31 athletes. That's just their allocation. So nothing really they can do about it. So right, I think it's probably as fair as it can be, but yeah, but tough, definitely tough to make.
Yeah. Now you've got your, obviously your world champ standard. What does the season look like for you? Like the map of it? Cause obviously you got it out of the way in April. Does that change anything for you in terms of what you plan to do next?
Yeah, definitely changes things. You know, I was going to run another 1500 this weekend in Eugene, but there's obviously no point in doing that now. So sack that one off. We are still going to be going to the Sound Running Meet beginning of May. I think Vince will be going for his 1500 standard there, and I think Jake and I will probably be in the race as well. So, you know, it should be a fast race. And there'll be some world rankings points on the line there as well, so always worth having. But looking beyond that, I'm not quite sure yet. You know, I'm still sort of working on it with my agent to sort of figure out what I can and can't get into. I mean, I'm hoping that you know, with that time early on in the season, it might give me an opportunity to get a run out at maybe a couple of Diamond Leagues later in the season. Hopefully pre-classic here in Eugene would be great. Obviously the competition to get, you know, a spot on the line in that is really tough. But you know, if that can happen, that'd be brilliant. Whether that's in the Bowerman or the International Mile, we'll see. But yeah, I mean, really, it's just nice to have that peace of mind of knowing you got the standard, it's out of the way. And in a way you just sort of run a bit more freely, you know, and now it's a case of just going out and trying to get those opportunities to race better opposition and just race, you know, race for the win. Because ultimately, you know, that's what really matters. And that's what I'm going to be wanting to do towards the end of the summer, Worlds or Commonwealths, hopefully. So just, yeah, trying to get into some better races, maybe make a bit of money and yeah, race some good guys. That's sort of the plan, really.
Absolutely. Mate, in Eugene, obviously everyone knows the world champ's going to be in Oregon this year. Talk about, you know, there's a lot of talk about kind of the heat that time of year, but especially the kind of hay fever and the pollen count, and that can affect, you know, we used to see it with Galen Rupp wearing a mask and, you know, crazy things like that. Is it as bad? Do you suffer from any of that? And, you know, what is it like that kind of June, you know, May, June time, July time in Eugene?
Yeah. I mean, thankfully, no, I don't have any problems with like hay fever or anything, which is nice. I'm quite grateful for that. And, you know, I mean, some of my teammates do, and I've seen how much they suffer sometimes in the summer. So I'm glad I don't. But yeah, from by all accounts, I've heard it's really bad for those who do suffer from it. Also, as you say, I mean, the heat can be, you know, quite difficult. Last year around US trials, you know, I was here for the US Olympic trials and watching that and watching my teammates. And, you know, it was up to like 42, 43 degrees, you know, on one of the trials days. It was ridiculous. And that's not usual, but it's not like, it's not that much hotter than is usual. So, you know, it can certainly be up in the like mid 30s around that sort of time. So yeah, it could be really hot for the Worlds. You know, don't know for sure, but the other thing I will say about Eugene is you never know what the weather's going to bring you, and it can change just like that. So might be sunny one day and pour under the rain the next in mid July. There's every chance of that too. So we'll see, but yeah, definitely could be tough conditions, but you know, with some of the recent world championships where they've been, you know, in Doha and stuff, like I don't think it's quite as tough as that. So, you know, if and Tokyo as well, obviously was difficult conditions as well. So it's just part of the game, really, and you've got to get used to it. And I think we'll probably, you know, we might do some heat acclimation stuff maybe for it as we get close to the championships, if Mark thinks that's going to be necessary, but we'll see.
There's Is there a buzz? You're obviously from there. You're living there at the moment. Is there a buzz currently there? I mean, I was speaking to someone the other day, and apparently 2 weeks either side of the world champs, everything is just booked up already. You know, B&Bs, hotels.
Yeah.
The people know it's coming down.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, you know, the people here really, really do love the sport, which is cool, you know, and it's one of the great things about being based here is, you know, we're out for a run and, you know, people wave to you, people say, oh, well done on your race last weekend, you know.
Wow.
Random people, you know, who follow the sport, which is cool. So definitely there's a buzz about it. And I think it's going to be a great world championships. You know, it's the first time it's been in the US. And I think really, you know, this is probably the perfect place for it. The new stadium at the U of O is incredible. And, you know, I can't wait to hopefully get the opportunity to race there. So yeah, it's going to be great. But as you say, with that comes all the logistics of getting tickets, getting accommodation and stuff for the people who want to come watch. And yeah, I mean, it is madness. I mean, the, you know, people are leaving town for a week to be able to just Airbnb their house for a week because they can Airbnb it for like $5,000, stuff like that. It's crazy. Yeah. So I'm glad I don't have to worry about that. You know, I'm probably just going to be sleeping in my own bed here 5 minutes from the stadium. It'll be nice, but yes, it's madness. And, but super exciting. And I think, you know, a lot of people in the town are excited and ready for it. So yeah, a lot of planning's gone into it. And, you know, I'm friends with a few people who, you know, who are closely involved in the planning for it and the marketing and everything for it, and they're super excited about it all as well. So it should be great.
Yeah, for sure. I think a lot of people are looking forward to that across the world to watch. But look, that's this season. What about beyond that? How much do you think about kind of the next 3 years, the next 5 years? Is that something you and Mark, your coach, discuss?
Not too much. I think, you know, we try and keep it a little bit more short term. It's a bit more realistic and a bit more easy to sort of set goals for, I think. I've never been one for sort of looking too far into the future, and certainly not for looking into the past. So you know, for me, I'm really just focused on this year. You know, I still feel, you know, like I've got a lot to prove this year, and, you know, be that to other athletes, to the world of our sport in general, or sponsors or whatever. So for me, the real focus is just on this year and doing the absolute best I can with Worlds and Commonwealths. And then, you know, we'll see after that. I mean, obviously, as an athlete in this sport, like the Olympics is the highest level and is the ultimate goal for so many of us. And, you know, that hasn't changed. I was, as we touched on already, you know, I was obviously massively disappointed last year to miss out on that. And I going into that year, I really did think that was going to be the year for me. You know, I was going to qualify for Tokyo and go to Tokyo and everything, and it didn't work out. And so for me, yes, absolutely, like Paris is still, you know, a huge goal of mine, but that's several years away still. So yes, it's a goal. Yes, it's there in the back of my mind, but I'm trying not to focus on that too much and really just sort of stay within the confines of this year at least, and just focus on doing the absolute best I can with the competitions and the meets that are happening this year before I sort of worry about anything beyond that.
Yeah, totally makes sense. And just one final thing I was just going to ask you, you know, given you are an athlete and you've mentioned it a little bit, these world ranking points, do you take, you know, do you plan a race to try and maximize those points? Like, is that starting to cross your mind? Is the rankings now, what are they, their second season in these points at all? Or you kind of just, you know, ignore them?
I think you have to consider it. And it is important because, you know, it plays a big part in getting into certain meets, you know, where you're ranked. And for contract purposes as well, you know, there are bonuses for world rankings.
Right. Okay.
And things like that. So, I mean, it can obviously, it's for worlds and stuff, it's nice to just get the standard and you don't have to worry about the world rankings for that. And, you know, I don't think they haven't quite perfected the system. I think it's still somewhat flawed in the way that it distributes points, because at the moment it seems to me, you know, it's the same people that are getting into the meets that have the points available, which keep them up in the rankings, which keep them getting into the meets. You know, it's very difficult to break into that sort of group if you're not already in it, if you know what I mean. And just, you know, the amount of points that are awarded for running at a Diamond League, you know, it makes such a huge difference that, you know, my running 333 at Brian Clay, you know, is worthless compared to someone running 337 in a Diamond League, you know, even though there's like a 4 second difference. Yeah. I just don't think that should be the case. It's, you know, if you're going to award points based on the opposition you beat, and, you know, some of the opposition that you beat still runs 335 or 336, I mean, that's good opposition. You know, to award no bonus points at all for Brian Clay when it's one in 333 to me seems ridiculous. So, you know, I think there's, and I'm sure that there will be adjustments made to the system as it goes on. And I don't think it's overall a bad thing. But you certainly have to start thinking about it. And you know, part of the reason that I want to get into these better races, you know, this summer is also that, you know, the importance of those world rankings points, because, you know, at the moment, the races that I'm getting into don't really offer many of those points. So unless you're running, you know, 332 every time you go out and run and race, then you're not ever going to be able to crack into that sort of next level of competitions. And realistically, you know, you're not going to be running 332 every race unless you're in those sort of competitions. So it can be a bit frustrating, but yeah, I'm hoping that this year, you know, I'll get the opportunity to run in some more of those races, Diamond Leagues, gold level, silver, whatever, tour, things like that. But we'll see. I mean, again, for me, ultimately, you know, the main focus this year is Worlds and Commonwealths. And, you know, we'll see what happens after that. I mean, if I run well at both of those, I should be all right, I think. So.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. Right. Yeah. Interesting to hear your take on that. And Will, just thanks for coming on the podcast. It's been great.
Yeah, no problem at all. Thank you, guys. It's been a lot of fun.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.